Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Frances Alonso reporting. A military official in the Libyan capital says a helicopter has been shot down near Tripoli, killing at least 14 of its 23 passengers. Tripoli Chief of Staff spokesman Colonel Ali al-Sheikhi says two high-ranking officers allied to the Islamist-backed Tripoli government were on board. He says the helicopter departed at noon to transport salaries to the town of Sirman and was shot down near the Amaya area west of Tripoli. He added that 14 bodies had been retrieved so far and survivors had yet to be found. Ivory Coast's Election Commission is widely expected to announce Tuesday the first results from an election that was widely expected to give President Alassane Ouattara another term in office. The commission has already estimated turnout from Sunday's vote at around 60%, though a civil society group has put that figure at 53%. Voters in the Republic of Congo have overwhelmingly approved a constitutional referendum that will allow President Denis Sassou Nguesso to seek another term. Official results released Tuesday show more than 92% of voters backing the referendum, with turnout at 72%. However, the opposition boycotted that vote and said the turnout was actually much lower, down around in the single digits. The International Criminal Court in India said India should, or rather the International Criminal Court said India should arrest and hand over Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir. He's wanted on genocide charges and is expected to visit New Delhi for a summit this week. Along with 40 other African leaders, the 71-year-old president is expected to arrive in New Delhi on Wednesday to attend an India-Africa summit aimed at boosting trade and investment. This is VOA News. The medical charity Doctors Without Borders said Tuesday that Saudi-led airstrikes hit its facility in Yemen's capital, but that there were no serious casualties. The group said the facility in Sana'a was bombed at least twice overnight, causing major damage to the building. MSF said staff members and critically wounded patients were evacuated from the hospital in between the two airstrikes. Pakistani Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif said Tuesday that his government will make every effort to help those affected by Monday's magnitude 7.5 earthquake and is to announce a relief package once authorities carry out a comprehensive assessment. Sharif held a meeting of high-level officials to hear reports on the damage and response since the earthquake struck northern Afghanistan's sparsely populated Badakhshan province. Both Pakistan and Afghanistan have reported nearly 350 deaths and around 1,900 people have been injured. In what is seen as the most significant challenge yet to territorial limits Beijing asserts around its man-made islands, a U.S.-guided missile destroyer Tuesday sailed within 22 kilometers of a reef in the disputed Spratly Archipelago. VOA correspondent Steve Harmon reports.
The USS Lassen approached Subi Reef, occupied by China and also claimed by Taiwan, Vietnam, and the Philippines. The foreign ministry in Beijing accuses the vessel of illegally entering its waters, posing a threat to Chinese sovereignty. It says the Navy ship was monitored, followed, and warned. A U.S. military source says the mission was completed without incident. Sheila Smith, senior fellow for Japan Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, says the U.S. Navy's challenge to China comes amid increasing rhetoric from Beijing about the need to defend its sovereign territory. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
Pakistan's military says heavy fire from across the Afghan border killed seven Pakistani soldiers on Tuesday. That attack hit a paramilitary force outpost in south of Waziristan's Angar Ada region. The military did not say whether militants or Afghan soldiers were responsible, and there was no immediate comment from Afghanistan. The neighboring countries have in the past accused each other's forces of initiating the cross-border fire. Congressional leaders have reached a tentative deal with the Obama administration on a government spending plan that could avoid another contentious budget standoff between the White House and hardline conservative Republicans. The plan must now be approved by the House and Senate and signed by the president next Tuesday, November 3rd, when the government's current borrowing authority expires. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Suhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
A new report shows increasing numbers of migrants are moving to cities around the world to take advantage of the many opportunities urban centers offer. The International Organization for Migration's World Migration Report 2015 focuses on both the risks and opportunities created by the rate of fast urbanization.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from Geneva. Details coming up.
Also, the first results from the election in Ivory Coast is widely expected to give President Alassane Ouattara another term in office. And voters in the Republic of Congo overwhelmingly approved a constitutional referendum that will allow President Denis Sassou Nguesso to seek another seven-year term.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Rwanda, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story, Ivory Coast Election Commission is expected to announce today the first results from an election that was widely expected to give President Alassane Ouattara another term in office. The commission has already estimated turnout from Sunday's vote at around 60%, but a civil society group says it's closer to 53%. The opposition's National Coalition for Change almost most voters actually stayed home, and fewer than 20% voted. Three opposition candidates pulled out before the vote and alleged irregularities. They claimed a voter list had many people registered twice. They also charged that some voter stations had to stay open late because ballots were late arriving and computer tablets used to verify identities malfunctioned. International observers from the African Union and the West African Bloc, ECOWAS, said the voting was free and fair.
Ouattara said he wanted to win a first-round knockout. This election is seen as an important test for the country because post-election violence 5 years ago left at least 3,000 dead. In 2010, Ouattara lost the first round to the incumbent, President Laurent Gbagbo, in the runoff. Officials' results showed Ouattara winning, but a Gbagbo-controlled constitutional council threw out some ballots and declared Gbagbo the winner. When the international community recognized Ouattara as the winner, Gbagbo refused to step down. That started off 5 months of violence. Gbagbo was captured by pro-Ouattara forces, backed by French special forces. Ouattara later assumed power. Gbagbo is in custody at the International Criminal Court and due to go on trial November 10th.
Opposition parties in Congo-Brazzaville are rejecting the result of Sunday's constitutional referendum. Results show the referendum passing with 92% of votes, clearing the way for longtime President Denis Sassou Nguesso to run again in 2016. Nick Long has more from the neighboring DRC.
An alliance of opposition parties called FROCAD called for voters to boycott this referendum. It claims that nearly all of them did. FROCAD spokesman Guy Romain Kinfusia disputes the official turnout figure of 72%. He claims the real turnout was more like 3%.
Nous le récusons. Nous demandons à Monsieur Sassou de retirer ce référendum.
We reject the results, he tells VOA. The opposition will ask Mr. Sassou Nguesso to withdraw this result and sit down for inclusive talks on holding elections in 2016, in which he will not be a candidate. Kinfusia adds if Sassou does not agree, the opposition will continue with civil disobedience. The European Union called last week for an inclusive dialogue in Congo-Brazzaville as a matter of urgency. According to FROCAD, the voting process on Sunday was a sham.
C'était pas secret. Monsieur Sassou et son équipe, ils ont promené des électeurs dans des bus.
Kinfusia says the government took groups of voters by bus to several different polling stations where they did not have to present voters' cards. He also says people were paid to vote. Analyst Paul Melly, who follows Congo-Brazzaville's politics for the research organisation Chatham House, says the result was in line with all of the Republic of Congo's polls since 2002.
Basically, the government controls the election process very strongly. Most opponents know that they're fighting a very unequal battle, and very many voters can't see any point in participating at all. So the official figures that have been announced are completely unsurprising. Anecdotal on-the-ground evidence suggests that turnout was actually very low in many places.
One of Congo's leading opposition politicians, Guy Brice Parfait-Kolelas, has been under house arrest with about 30 of his supporters since last Thursday.
Nous avons demandé à Monsieur Bativille, qui est le représentant de Monsieur Ban Ki-moon.
Kinfusia says his group has asked the United Nations to negotiate Kolelas' release, but Sassou has refused without explanation. Kolelas has complained he is running out of food as presidential guards surrounding his house have confiscated supplies. Nick Long for VOA News, Goma, DRC.
Tanzania's ruling party says it has won up to 60% of all votes tallied so far. However, the opposition says that's not true and accuses the Chama cha Mapinduzi party of using untrue rhetoric to weaken its critics. Reporter William Eagle spoke with VOA's Vincent Makori, who is in Dar es Salaam, for the latest news.
Well, you know, the system here is so complicated in that because the media is not allowed to clearly, you know, release any totals from, you know, those that have been announced after this point, you kind of keep just listening to the Electoral Commission releasing piecemeal results from different regions. But from some of the calculations that have been done, the opposition party is lagging behind the ruling party. In fact, the difference is about 20%. Up to this point, the opposition, or rather the ruling party CCM, has garnered about 59% of the votes that have been announced, while the opposition has about 39% of all that have been announced up to this point. But this is a critical thing here. Most of those that have been announced are from the stronghold of the ruling party. And that is why the opposition is wondering why there is a delay in announcing the results from the opposition stronghold. And therefore, they claim this is a kind of a psychological game where they're trying to break down the spirits of the opposition, prepare them for losing, by already giving that indication that the ruling party is leading way far by about 20% up to this point.
Who is releasing the numbers? Is it coming from the Electoral Commission or from the ruling party or a government spokesman? Or is it somehow simply being leaked by an unknown source, either on the social media or somehow to the press? The question remains, is this legal?
No, what's happening is there's an official release which is being done by the Electoral Commission. In fact, the Electoral Commission chairman comes on after every 1 hour to give his briefing, to do to make an announcement of the regions which have reported in or where votes have been verified and they're being announced. So this is actually being done officially by the Electoral Commission chairman or some of his officials. And that's the only source of information that is accepted and allowed by law right now in Tanzania.
So it is certainly legal for the Electoral Commission to release figures that it wishes.
Exactly. I mean, they're giving explanations as to why they haven't released figures from some other parts of the country. They claim some of those areas are slow. I mean, they're so far away. It took a bit longer to get everything together. And there are issues that are, you know, cause a little delay, but they say they will announce all these results. They have time. The law allows them to go on. And so they're calling on people to just be patient. And they keep announcing after every hour. The frustrating thing is that they just do like a few regions of the country and then they disappear again.
Legally, who are the watchdogs at the polling booths or even after the polling booths where ballots will be safeguarded or perhaps counted again later at another center?
Those would be the different agents of the parties that are represented in the election. All the participating political parties that allowed an agent at a polling station. And when the the polling station closes and they conclude the business of counting, the agents are allowed to be there to confirm that the number that was announced at the polling station is the same number that has been announced by the Electoral Commission officials.
When will the final tally be released? What's the official word from the Electoral Commission? And also, what, according to law, are the steps if the opposition or even the ruling party wishes to contest a tally?
First, I have to say that the Electoral Commission chairman had said that he is expecting to announce the final results by Thursday, but he could do it on Friday, as they say, depending on how things look like on the ground. So nobody can be 100% sure when the final one will be released. As for what is the legal recourse for those who may feel that they have been kind of a dealt an unfair blow, there is. They say you can petition without signing. You know, you don't sign the results. You can dispute them and go ahead and report to the Electoral Commission that you are not happy and satisfied that the numbers you're getting are accurate, and then after that you can present it further to the court of law, where they say it will be a new thing because there was never a provision for a petition in the court of law.
That's VOA's Vincent McCorry in Dar es Salaam speaking with reporter William Eagle.
A report shows increasing numbers of migrants are moving to cities around the world to take advantage of the many opportunities urban centers offer. The International Organization for Migration's World Migration Report 2015 focuses on both the risk and opportunities created by the rate of fast urbanization. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
More than half of the world's population lives in cities. Demographers expect the current urban population of 3.9 billion to grow to an estimated 6.4 billion by 2050. That means nearly 70% of the global population will be living in urban areas. The International Organization for Migration reports migration is driving much of the increase. It says most of the movement to big cities happens within countries and not as a consequence of people seeking a better life abroad. The latest statistics show there are an estimated 230 million international migrants and more than 740 million internal migrants. The report's editor-in-chief, June Lee, says one in seven people on the planet is on the move, with most heading for big cities within their own country. She says most of the migrants do not have the right to legally reside in their national urban centers. She says they resort to irregular means, which makes them vulnerable to exploitation. Lee says the migrants usually live in informal settlements and work in black market jobs where they live in fear of being discovered and are open to abuse.
They still make living, find opportunity for employment and income, and also protection they're coming away from. Disaster, possibly, and political instability back home. So they find, nonetheless, protection opportunity in their harsh environment. Therefore, it is very difficult to stop.
Lee says about 85% of more than 100 countries surveyed by the United Nations have policies in place to halt urban migration. Given the global realities of aging societies, she says large-scale migration to urban centers is inevitable. Therefore, city authorities should come up with policies that better integrate migrants as a beneficial part of their communities. The report finds about 50% of international migrants live in 10 highly urbanized, wealthy countries, including Australia, Canada, the United States, and several countries in Europe and the Middle East. But it notes almost all of the population growth of 2.5 billion people over the next few decades is expected to be in urban areas in poorer African and Asian countries. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
French police have begun moving about 300 people from a seaside migrant camp in Calais to temporary housing in the provinces of Brittany and Lorraine. The migrants agreed to the move after being camped for many months near the entrance to the railroad tunnel beneath the English Channel, hoping to get to England. Meanwhile, the Czech Republic says it may take in about 150 Christians who fled from the Islamic State in Iraq. Prime Minister Bohuslav Sobotka says the Christians are living in a refugee camp in Erbil in Iraq. Also, Slovenia says it will tighten its borders following similar moves by neighboring Balkan countries. Germany will send 4 federal police officers to aid Slovenia in patrolling its border. The EU has announced plans to send 400 officers.
Also, the EU's border agency Frontex has repeated its appeal for nearly 800 experts to help register, screen, and fingerprint migrants arriving in Italy and Greece. Frontex has received only half that number. Across the Mediterranean, the Libyan Red Crescent reports 40 bodies have been found on the coastline near the ports of Zlit and Khomes. The International Organization for Migration says they may be victims of a week-old shipwreck. The IOM says more than 3,000 migrants and refugees have died trying to cross the Mediterranean Sea this year. Most were sailing from Libya to Italian shores. You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suhib, 22 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. The first results from the election in Ivory Coast is widely expected to give President Alassane Ouattara another term in office. And voters in the Republic of Congo overwhelmingly approved a constitutional referendum that will allow President Denis Sassou Nguesso to seek another term. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
A conference opened today in Johannesburg addressing the challenges facing South African and U.S. women in the science and technology fields. The conference focuses on gender equality and addresses challenges faced by both Black South African women and Black American women in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. Washington, D.C.-based Howard University is sponsoring the Women in STEM Conference South Africa. STEM is the acronym for Science, Technology, Engineering, and Mathematics. Howard University is one of America's historic Black college and university institutions, or HBUCs. The school has received a $3.4 million Advanced Institutional Transformation Award from the National Science Foundation to promote the careers of women faculty in STEM. Dr. Sonia T. Smith is a mechanical engineering professor and director of Howard University's Project for Women in STEM. She spoke with me about the importance of the conference.
Howard University Advanced is a project funded by the National Science Foundation to help attract, promote, and retain more women in STEM at Howard University. And Howard University has had a South Africa project since 1995 when President Mandela came to Howard to request its help in improving the status and situation of the South Africans and the South African economy. So we have worked with South Africa for almost 20 years now. And so this was a great synergy to institutionalize the Women in STEM project as well as South Africa. And it's so important because a lot of educational opportunities were deprived and denied to the Black South Africans. And so this conference is going to help bridge the gap and provide opportunities for research, collaboration, for student exchange among the faculty that are going. And we have primarily women of color in the STEM fields, ranging from medicine to engineering, biology, mathematics, attending this conference, and what they'll be able to partner and make connections with their counterparts in South Africa.
What do you see are some of the biggest challenges that Black South African women face, especially in the fields of science, technology, engineering, and mathematics?
They face the same challenges that the U.S. women face in those fields. Culture and climate issues, access to resources, particularly at the faculty level. There is a study that shows that women faculty have less access to discretionary funding, startup funding, lab space, et cetera. And the South African women have the same issues. So they're really universal for women in STEM, and particularly for women of color.
Are the challenges the same for women of all colors and all backgrounds, or do women, Black women particularly, have more challenges?
Black women have a different set of challenges and more challenges. They do have a different set of challenges.
What would be some of those challenges?
Some of the challenges would be obviously racism. Sexism is experienced differently for women of color versus other women. There's some cultural issues as well for women of color that do not exist for women of, you know, other races. In particular, family obligations, although all women have family obligations, particularly my colleagues in South Africa and throughout the diaspora. Sometimes the family obligations and the expectations of the family weigh a lot heavier on them than they do for other women.
As a professor of mechanical engineering at Howard University, how do you attract women to those types of fields, to the sciences and technology?
You have to give them competitive offers. That's number one, to attract faculty. You have to make sure that department climate and the university climate is such that it has mitigated some of the unconscious biases that exist and are directed towards women. You have to have adequate mentoring, sponsorship, and leadership development for them.
What would you say are some of the biggest advantages for Black women to go into this field?
I think some of the biggest advantages are typically the STEM fields are the more lucrative fields as far as salary and compensation, and that's all over the world, particularly in South Africa, the mining industry, petroleum industry, and all throughout Africa. Those are very lucrative fields, but they also tend to be the most hostile. But I think that salary potential, the potential to make an impact, is very attractive in the STEM field.
Looking ahead, what do you want the takeaway to be from the conference?
I want the takeaway from the conference to be a network, or the beginnings of a network, among women from HBCUs in the U.S. and HDIs in South Africa and their students for research exchanges, for faculty exchange, and for research collaboration, so that we can all collaborate and lift each other.
That was Dr. Sonia T. Smith, a mechanical engineering professor and director of Howard University's Project for Women in STEM.
This is African News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi right here in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami. Thanks for joining us. We love to have you on board. This is Upfront on The Voice of America. Hot, hot.
Upfront is a show that explores issues
that affect your daily lives. Don't move. Don't move that dial. Get your snacks. Get your cup of tea or your cup of coffee. Put your feet up. This is Upfront. Cheers, cheers. Clink, clink.
Yeah. Now there's the youth culture that is being practiced by the youth globally.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I feel like the problem is that once the funds are sent to
with developing countries, it sometimes gets in the wrong hands, and then it's the actual people that are supposed to be benefiting from these funds really never even get to see.
What does this mean for your local culture? Is it being threatened? Should your parents be worried? Let's talk. This is Upfront on the Voice of America. You can follow me on Twitter. My handle is at Upfront Africa. And remember, you can always send us an email here on the show. It's upfront@voanews.com.
The Voice of America, VOA.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. The first results from the election in Ivory Coast are widely expected to give President Alassane Ouattara another term in office. And voters in the Republic of Congo overwhelmingly approved a constitutional referendum that will allow President Denis Sassou Nguesso to seek another seven-year term. Coming up, we'll have music from Rwanda, and in our feature segment, religious justifications for violence are on the rise in Africa. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehia Swuheep, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Tuesday, Sunny.
Happy Tuesday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you are tipping off with basketball.
Kim, let's begin with basketball.
They're playing basketball. We love that basketball.
The National Basketball Association tips off a new season later Tuesday night with three games. The Chicago Bulls host LeBron James and the Cleveland Cavaliers. The Atlanta Hawks are at home against the Detroit Pistons. And reigning MVP Stephen Curry and the defending NBA champion Golden State Warriors entertain the New Orleans Pelicans. Before coming to the studio, I bumped into VOA colleague Mwamoyo Hoops Hamza in the hallway, and Hoops Hamza said, "Sonny, don't be surprised if Golden State and Cleveland play each other again in the NBA Finals." In this Sunny Side of Sports highlight for 2015, I give kudos to the Warriors for lifting the trophy in June. Here's a Sunny Side of Sports salute to the Golden State Warriors, who won their first National Basketball Association championship in 40 years. The Warriors scored a 105-97 road victory over the Cleveland Cavaliers to win the NBA Finals 4-2. League MVP Stephen Curry scored 25 points for the Warriors, a total matched by teammate Andre Iguodala. The 31-year-old Iguodala, whose father is Nigerian, was named the most valuable player of the NBA Finals. Golden State's head coach is Steve Kerr, who won 5 NBA titles as a player and now his first as a coach. Kerr began his post-game news conference with praise for the Cavaliers.
Congratulations to Cleveland, to Coach Blatt, who did a fantastic job. You think about the injuries they had, two of their top three players going down. And for them to have the season that they had and to get to the finals and to compete at the highest level and to have us on the ropes, it's an amazing job. And obviously LeBron is just an incredible player. So congrats to the Cavs. We were fortunate in a lot of ways this year. Maybe number one was health. To win a title, there's obviously a lot of work, but a lot of luck as well. And we had a lot of luck on our side this year, and our guys took advantage of it, and they were fantastic. But, man, what a night.
As Coach Kerr said, LeBron James is an incredible basketball player. He averaged almost 36 points, 13 rebounds, and 9 assists each game during the NBA Finals. But it was not enough for Cleveland to win its first NBA title. One of the key players for the Warriors in their title-clinching victory was forward Draymond Green, who had a team-high 11 rebounds and 10 assists. Green says the club's savior in the NBA Finals, though, was Andre Iguodala.
Andre is that guy that we all look to when everything going bad. I mean, whether it's him taking a back seat and letting Harrison start, you know, and not mumbling a word about coach's decision all year. And then coming in, he was great the entire series, not just when he started starting. He was great the entire series, but he saved this season for us. I always say Andre's a pro's pro. He's a professional guy, and it showed, and that's why he's the MVP of this series, and that's why we're champions.
That's Draymond Green of the Golden State Warriors, the 2015 NBA champions. We heard from Golden State coach Steve Kerr earlier. Kerr will not be leading the Warriors Tuesday night when they host the New Orleans Pelicans in their opening game. He's had two recent back surgeries and is still recovering. Luke Walton, one of the sons of Basketball Hall of Famer Bill Walton, is the interim Golden State coach until Kerr returns. Speaking of coaches, Zimbabwe football coach Kalisto Pasua is earning kudos, as we hear now from reporter Michael Cariotti in Harare.
The former Dynamo's coach has taken Zimbabwe's Warriors to the 2016 African Nations Championship Finals, only 2 months after he took the national junior team, the Young Warriors, to the Africa Games Festival held in the Congo. This comes after a Roderick Ntuma's strike saw the Warriors settle for a 1-0 draw against the Crocodiles of Lesotho in Maseru, leaving Zimbabwe sailing through to the finals 4-2 on aggregate. The Warriors had won the first leg 3-1 in Harare, and after finishing fourth at the last finals in South Africa, Captain Danny Phiri is hoping this time around they'll go through to the final and hopefully win the tournament.
I would like to promise them that we'll go through to the finals this time.
Pasua will also go into history as the only coach in Zimbabwean football to win 4 consecutive league titles after achieving that feat with the Dynamos when winning the championship in 2011, 2012, 2013 and 2014. The Warriors' qualification also comes barely a week after the women's soccer team, the Mighty Warriors, had also qualified for the 2016 Olympic Games to be held in Rio de Janeiro. However, there was no joy back at home for Pasua's former club Dynamos, who dropped 2 crucial points after stuttering to a 1-0 draw against relegation-threatened Flame Lily at Lafarge. Although the club's supporters still had belief after last week's goalless draw against Harare City, this time they are singing another tune saying the league title is all but gone. One of them is Amon Makore.
No hope, no hope, no hope. The race is between now, it's chicken in and platinum. We are out of the race now.
Even coach Tondera Indiraya admits the league title is no longer in their hands, saying it is now chicken in or FC Platinum's for the taking. Leaders Chicken Inn and second placed FC Platinum are scheduled to play each other on Wednesday at Luveve Stadium. The Premier Soccer League are still to respond to Chicken Inn, who have requested for the postponement of the game, saying they want to assess some of their players who are in Lesotho with the national team. However, there is good news for Cholocho Pirates, who have moved out of the relegation zone after a 1-0 win over Lloyd Mutasaswawa. The win sees them share 26 points with the Buffaloes, but the Mutare-based Zimbabwe National Army side, who lost 1-0 at home to Wange, have dropped to fourth from bottom on goal difference. Harare City have also dropped 1 place down the ladder after being overtaken by Wange in sixth position. This comes after the 2-0 home draw with Haumain, with so coach Taurai Mangwiro blaming referee Josiah Masimire instead of his strikers, who missed too many chances.
How do you explain a kung fu style from the goalkeeper? Someone sees no offense in that. I thought somebody must have played a part in frustrating our players.
Sunday Chizambwa ZPC Kariba are now in ninth place after a 4-1 spanking of Dongo Sawmills, a result that gives bottom place Dongo little chances of survival. Reporting in Harare, this is Michael Cariati.
Eight candidates have officially thrown their hats into the ring to be the next president of FIFA, World Football's governing body, which has been rocked by a corruption scandal this year. They are Prince Ali bin Al Hussein from Jordan, two Frenchmen, Michel Platini and Jerome Champagne, former Trinidad and Tobago captain David Nakid, UEFA General Secretary Gianni Infantino, he's a Swiss lawyer, Bahraini royal Sheikh Salman bin Brahim Al Khalifa, he's the head of the Asian Football Confederation, and two Africans, Musa Beliti from Liberia and Tokyo Sekhwale from South Africa. In Johannesburg Tuesday, Sekhwale addressed the media.
FIFA, the organization of the beautiful game, is damaged. The brand is severely undermined. I have been with FIFA in football for 9 years. Next year, February, I shall be finishing a whole decade in FIFA. FIFA is broken, and what is broken is the administration of FIFA. Now, for me, that's cakewalk. That's the easiest thing that I know, administration. To run organizations whose budgets and finances are far, 10, 20 times bigger than FIFA. FIFA doesn't have money. Of course, it has made a lot of money under Mr. Blatter. But I've administered organizations, banks, mining companies, far larger than FIFA, both in the country and abroad. Listed companies, South Africa, Australia, New York Stock Exchange and London. Now, that's the knowledge you want to bring into FIFA. It's a very simple thing. What has been broken in FIFA is the inability to follow money. Money has got traces. It's got invoices. It's got to follow the money. If you follow the money, it's got fingerprints. It's got footprints. It's got tracks. And if it disappears, find out who the last person was there who was standing.
Follow the money. That South African businessman, Tokyo Sekhwale, one of his country's wealthiest men, as well as an anti-apartheid activist and former political prisoner. In fact, the 62-year-old Sekhwale was once jailed alongside Nelson Mandela on Robben Island. He's trying to become the first African to head FIFA in its 111-year history in presidential elections scheduled in just under 4 months on February 26th in Zurich, Switzerland. And in case you're wondering about Tokyo's name, well, it has a sporting tie. Tokyo enjoyed karate when he was a boy, the martial art that was developed in Japan. Whether he or the seven other candidates can clean up FIFA, well, I guess that remains to be seen. Owen Gibson, writing in the British daily The Guardian on Tuesday, said, and I quote, "The eight candidates come with enough baggage to put an airport terminal to shame." Ouch! Doesn't sound too promising there. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yehias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Okay, ouch there. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 1730 hours UTC. Right here on The Voice of America.
Coming up, religious justifications for violence on the rise in Africa. And next, 3.9 million people in South Sudan are at the highest level of food insecurity. But first, some music. Here is Kamachi from Rwanda with Tuntizi Bantu.
Preach, recourse. Ego shaka mishikula kulisha masere piano na jibgaji jibgaji.
amafaranga ngiye kwishyurira uyu mwana baciye kwibara fashe rimwe mfashe irindi sengere y'abasinzi bati dore umugabo w'isanga je baba we ngenze ne nigishe ko ndebuje n'umugore nabyo azi n'umuneze nzica mande nzakwishyura ku wa kane wihangane
Machi from Rwanda with Tutsi Bantu.
Well, religious justifications for violence have been on the rise in Africa. Experts met in Nairobi recently to examine ways of reducing the rising levels of radicalization among the youth. From the Kenyan capital, VOA's Ruben Kayama reports.
Participants from Nigeria, Cameroon, and Kenya explored the local contexts of religious violence and examined the potential responses of African governments and security agencies. Speakers compared violent groups in northeast Nigeria, North Cameroon, and the coastal and northeast region of Kenya and cited various common factors that explore the problem. Ms. Fatma Chari Mohammed, a security expert from Nigeria, was among the key speakers at the forum.
It's about addressing the fundamental issues. The fundamental issues being the socioeconomic issues, the governance issues, corruption, weak states, holding our leadership accountable, the issue of impunity, the lack of understanding of the core issues where ideology is concerned.
Mohammed, a senior expert with a leading West African conflict and security consulting firm based in Nigeria, is now focusing our attention on the crisis in northern Nigeria.
There seems to be a lot of misconception and a lot of misunderstanding between the two major religions in this country. Where Nigeria is concerned, we've kind of de-passed that stage to a certain extent because people now understand that terrorism is not necessarily about religious ideology. It's more about political ideology and looking for alternatives. Alternatives for livelihoods, alternatives for a different kind of life, the greed and need for power.
Among those alternatives for livelihoods, said the forum participants, are solutions to youth unemployment and lack of participation in local and national politics. Father Wilbert Lago, Assistant Bishop of the Catholic Archdiocese of Mombasa, said religious leaders in collaboration with state organs and local communities were involved in finding solutions to the problem. He said one way was trying to ensure that the voices of the youth were heard. While this is not new for countries like Nigeria, Cameroon, and to some extent Kenya, it is a relatively novel phenomenon in the continent. Ms. Hawa Noor, a researcher at the Nairobi-based Institute of Security Studies, says there is a challenge in finding a clear definition of the words radicalization and terrorism.
From radicalization, who is a radical, who is an extremist, to the term terrorism, which does not have a scientific definition so far. So I think that is where the dilemma starts. And then it boils down to, you know, the whole issue of the perception of within particular societies like Kenya, which has been, affected by the problem of violent extremism.
Pundits say that many times exaggerated narratives and perceptions have been employed by national governments to justify punitive measures against entire communities, as Noor explains.
Looking at the responses that came out, does Islam, for example, promote terrorism, tells you that there's a problem, first of all, from the community level in terms of understanding each other. And I think even the issue of ethnicity, it's propagated because there's no national reconciliation. All these things are swept under the carpet sometime.
Sheikh Ibrahim Lithome, a Kenyan Islamic scholar, warned against widespread misuse of religious texts, which can be used by individuals as an excuse to commit violence.
Hakuna kundi moja ama mshikadao mmoja ambao.
He says everyone, including government, religious leaders, women groups, the society at large, as well as the media, should be involved in the debate. In Kenya, the Somali militant group Al-Shabaab has carried out several assaults across the country in the past few years, including the deadly massacre in 2013 at the Westgate shopping mall in Nairobi that left 67 people dead. In Cameroon, Boko Haram attacks have become the most visible sign of radicalization as the extremist group spreads violence from neighboring Nigeria. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
Three UN agencies say parts of South Sudan face imminent famine unless people get immediate food aid. The warning comes after the UN found that 3.9 million people in South Sudan are at the highest level of food insecurity. The report points out children from war-affected areas suffer the most. VOA's Lucy Pony has the story from Juba.
It was UNICEF, the World Food Programme, and the Food and Agriculture Organization that raised the alarm about looming famine in parts of South Sudan. They are calling on the parties to the conflict, which was supposed to have ended in August with the signing of a peace deal, to grant urgent and unrestricted access to high-risk areas, including parts of Unity States, where the IPC says at least 30,000 people face imminent starvation and death. UNICEF's Tyler says some villages in Unity and Upper Nile States have been cut off from receiving aid or even assessment visits from humanitarian workers for nearly 2 years.
So in some cases, we haven't been able to go since the beginning of the conflict. And some cases, we have not been able to go for over a year.
Tyler says when the peace agreement was signed in August, the UN agencies had expected it would become easier to reach the areas that were cut off by fighting. But, she says, nothing has changed in the 2 months since the peace deal was signed and a ceasefire declared. Tyler says children have been particularly hard hit by the crisis.
We are seeing children coming, malnourished. Children are sick. Children who have been traumatized. These children have lost everything. You know, they haven't been able to go to school.
Tyler says an estimated 4 million people have not had access to health care throughout the 22-month-old conflict. She says people have lost their sources of income and their hope for the future.
So they've lost everything, become traumatized, and these people are more at risk of getting their health condition getting worse.
World Food Programme regional spokeswoman Charles McDonough says unless aid agencies are given urgent and unrestricted access to all parts of South Sudan, there could be catastrophic hunger in places. She cites the example of Unity State, where
there are already estimated to be some 30,000 people who are experiencing what amounts to starvation in those areas. And unless agencies are able to reach people to provide assistance, the situation could deteriorate even worse in the coming months.
McDonough says access has been cut off to areas in Unity, Jonglei, and Upper Nile states. She says the international community must support humanitarian agencies with the resources they need to reach people across the country. For VOA News, I'm Lucy Pony in Nairobi.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Gender-based violence is a scourge from which no country is immune. It is estimated that globally, one out of three women faces violence during her lifetime for no other reason than her gender. As unfortunately commonplace as gender-based violence is under normal circumstances, it increases exponentially during conflict, natural disasters, and other humanitarian emergencies. In emergency situations, societal structures break down, and women and girls in particular face an increased risk of gender-based violence, including sexual exploitation and abuse, rape, domestic violence, forced marriage, and trafficking. That is why 2 years ago, representatives of a number of governments, transnational organizations, NGOs, and civil society organizations met in London under the leadership of the United Kingdom to form a call to action on protecting girls and women in emergencies. The United States took on leadership of the call to action in 2014. As a commitment to the call to action, the United States announced its Safe from the Start program, an initiative that aims to address and reduce the incidence of gender-based violence in emergencies. We have used Safe from the Start funding to help our partners assist thousands of displaced Iraqis. Safe from the Start supported training for refugees from the Central African Republic on how to respond to sexual exploitation and abuse, setting up complaint mechanisms and emergency phone lines to report abuses. And in the Congo, we are helping to establish security patrol teams and install solar lights in communities so that women and girls are able to venture outside after sundown. At a ministerial on gender-based violence in humanitarian emergencies, a meeting co-sponsored by the United States and Sweden, Secretary of State John Kerry announced an additional $17 million for Safe from the Start. If we are to be successful in this effort, said Secretary Kerry, we need to take action. We need a zero-tolerance policy toward gender-based violence against anyone, men, women, and children. We must treat the survivors of violence with the sensitivity, respect, and the dignity that they deserve, and we must bring perpetrators to justice. Finally, to be successful, we must all work together. We have learned in painful and searing ways that gender-based violence can rip families apart, rip communities apart, and attack state structures. And too often, in too many countries, it perpetrates conflict and creates instability for generations, said Secretary of State Kerry. Preventing and dealing with the effects of gender-based violence is a fundamental moral issue. It's a basic question of right versus wrong.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
VOA.
Hello, I'm Douglas Impoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.